Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm really excited today to be joined by two folks whose work has meant a lot to me over the years. John Harrison, who is the first AD and the composer, big thing here, composer, for Day of the Dead, George Romero's third zombie movie, the end of his kind of original zombie trilogy. And Jeff Roland, who is a producer at Shout Factory, who has helped kind of spearhead this really amazing, comprehensive new Day of the Dead set, new 4K transfer, tons of special features. You know, we were just kind of joking before the show started here, Jeff, that the reviews haven't started coming out. And you were like, what's the deal? But I will just tell you from personal experience, there's a lot of stuff. There is so much stuff on this new set. Let's just start here. When you're sitting down and you're putting together kind of a checklist of like, okay, here are the people we need to talk to on Day of the Dead, where do you start and who do you go to first?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm a fan. So I've had this list in my head for a while. Who I'd want to interview for this. I mean, that started the second I began looking for it 3 years ago. I was like, all right, so I'd sit here and daydream like, oh, who would I get for this? And I mean, I can tell you just from experience, like, these guys are a tight-knit family. I'd always heard that. And I did not know to what extent. I mean, just the love that was coming from each and every one of them. I mean, it would get to the point where, you know, I'd be talking to someone like John, and I'm like, well, hey, have you talked to this person? And everything, and like, oh, no, yeah, you know. Yeah, that whole process was a lot of fun, and I just constantly felt welcomed by them, which was, it was the best experience I've ever had, like, working on one of these titles.
I mean, it's funny because if you watch again all of the special features here, there's an archival documentary from the 2013 Shout Factory release, which I'm watching that and I'm like, I'm seeing people age in front of my eyes. It's an interesting thing. John, you're in all of these documentaries. You're there at the beginning. I want to talk about the making of this movie because it's a fascinating story. There's the long time, horror fans know that there's a whole backstory here, but the version of the film that ended up being made, which again is my favorite of this trilogy, is not the version that George Romero set out to make. It ended up being a coming together in a slightly different form. Isn't that right?
Yeah. George had a much longer script and a much grander vision for what Day of the Dead would be. The success of Dawn was so startling to everybody. I mean, I guess you could say that the success of Night was startling to everybody because they made it on a shoestring and basically just wanted to make a movie, make a horror movie, and it turned out to be this phenom. Dawn continued that. So he had a much bigger vision for what he wanted to do with Day, and as George is, he had lots to say about the world that he had created and where it was going. Unfortunately, that meant that there either had to be a rather much larger budget or certain changes would have to be made. And at the time, the original deal was with Saleh Hassanein and UFD, United Film Distributors. And Saleh basically came to George and said, I mean, this is the brief version of the whole thing. Look, George had a reputation of releasing his movies unrated because he felt that, especially with the graphic violence of his movies, even though we all knew how they were created and they were just more fun than disturbing, I guess, or at least to those of us that were making it, that if he wanted an R rating, then he would have to have he could possibly get the larger budget, which would accommodate that script. George said, no, it's got to go out unrated because I don't want the Motion Picture Academy telling me, well, you can only have this many headshots and you can only have this much gore and you can only do this, that, and the other thing. And Sala said, well, look, I'll release it unrated, but at that, doing that, it has to be at this price point, which was virtually, if I recall, almost half the budget that we had originally created. So George insisted and Sala insisted. And so we went back to the drawing boards and George came up with a different version of a lot of it was the same. The whole idea of the military compound and the research that Logan was doing and so forth, that remained. But the grand environment that he had imagined had to be curtailed. And frankly, a lot of that ended up in Land of the Dead. The whole Fiddler's Green environment, for example, was in the original. But a lot of it remained the same. The whole idea that it took place in a tropical setting, that remained the same, although we spent the entire time in a cave, so we didn't see that we didn't see that much of the tropical setting. But the interesting thing for me was that I had been working on the music with George prior to all of this going down. So it was, well, what do I do? Do I change the musical themes and so forth? And we'd kind of fallen in love with the sort of the tropical, I guess you'd say calypso. I don't really call it calypso, but that kind of theme music, which was indicative of the story. We wanted to keep that. And so we did. And that ended up being the score. Now, it's really interesting, Sonny, because, and I'll just say this real quickly, you know, when the movie came out, and I'm glad that you and Jeff and so many others loved this movie, George, I think, used to say that it was the favorite of his, of that original trilogy. But when it first came out, it was not popular at all. You might even say that it was kind of a bomb, that it took years to kind of percolate up through the fan base and become the icon that it is now. That was also true of the score. People hated the score. They didn't know what to make of it. It was not a horror score. and now it seems like people like it. So
what? No, it's figure. It's so funny because I mean, I came to these movies, you know, a little bit later. I think I was 3 years old when the first one came out. So I was not seeing Day of the Dead in the theaters. That was not a you know, an early family trip for me. But, you know, I come to it a little later and I'm a big fan of Night of the Living Dead, you know, obviously love Dawn of the Dead. And I see Day of the Dead and it is very different just tonally. It's very different musically. I'm so glad to have you on because the score of this film is so different from what you would expect from what is a fairly dark, you know, even in comparison to the first two here, a fairly dark, fairly, you know,
grim
is a good word for it. You know, zombie movie. And it's got this kind of lighter, more playful score. It's more of a, you know, hey, there are people down here and they're, you know, it is a little fun, but I've always loved it because it is so different because it does jump out at you as like, oh, this is an interesting choice. So when you guys were rejiggering it, you were just like, we're going to keep using this. This is still what we're going to do.
Well, yes, we decided that George loved the theme. One of the great things about our relationship was that, and Jeff alluded to this before the show started, that we had a family kind of relationship in Pittsburgh during this period of time. Everybody that wanted to be in the film business knew everybody else. We all worked together. And my relationship with George, both as his assistant director and as a composer, was kind of unique because I was there for the whole thing. So he and I could talk all the time. Well, what do you see in this scene? What kind of music do you want here? What's the feeling you're going for? And I want to make clear that George was very insistent that his movies were really not about the zombies. His movies were about the human condition that was created by the zombies. The zombies were just there. They were the big bad. They were the thing that you had to escape. But what he was really concerned about was the drama of the human community. So while the score is kind of counterintuitive in terms of what you would normally think of a horror score, it was really meant to drive the human story. So that was intentional all along, that the score was really there to service the emotions of what the characters were going through.
Let's talk about getting this film actually made, or getting this film actually restored, because, you know, there's a very, my favorite of the little kind of mini docs, the little interview docs that are on the last disc of this, is your kind of odyssey to toward finding the materials for this. I mean, I was a little bit surprised by that, because again, there was a release, I think it was 2013, which Shout and Scream Factory did. Is this, were you using different elements here, or did they get lost in the interim? Like, what was the search for? What were you looking for here that was, you know, kind of different from that?
Well, I mean, for the Blu-ray, for the 2013 Blu-ray, we did use the interpositive, which is what we used for this. I mean, when I first started looking for this, I was originally looking for the negative. I mean, because that's the highest you can get in terms of quality. But I hate to say this, like after a 2-year search, I truly hope I'm wrong. I think it is just gone. It is just lost to time. But I hope I'm wrong. So at that point, I was like, well, I got to get the interpositive because that's what was used in 2013. Unfortunately, sometimes what happens is films get passed along. They get licensed by other companies and such, and they are just passed back and forth. And record keeping is not the greatest. at least back then. I mean, that was something that I really found, because it was during that time where like everybody was kind of switching over to digital records. For example, like where I started off when the search was, all right, let me go find some records from around 2012 that'll help me at least get a start. So I went to the accounting department and was just like, hey, do you guys have any delivery records from that time? So I had a place to start. They're all in the basement, in boxes, on paper, you know. So there I was down in the basement, just coughing, sneezing through all these dusty boxes. And that was sort of a starting point for me. I don't know. What we did at the end of this was we made sure that everything was marked correctly. Everything was logged correctly. So, you know, when we get to the point in the future where people are downloading movies to their brain, like they can have like the 16K version of it. So welcome, the future.
I could just imagine going to the, you know, the brain implant store and being like, all right, I want Day of the Dead, and you get the 2008 one. You're like, no.
That happened twice to me, where there were many ups and downs during this, highs and lows, where I was just certain I had found it and ran over to the restoration house that we used, Duplitech, and we were sitting there inspecting the film, and all of a sudden there were just haircuts and clothing from 2008 and just, you know, deflated after that. But, you know, that sort of goes to my point where with records keeping, it just said Day of the Dead. It didn't say the year. And that happened twice during the search for it. But Eventually it was found.
Yeah. That's wild. And on this extra, you spend a lot of time at Duplatech, which I like. So this is, you know, this disc obviously has lots of stories about the making of the movie, talking, you know, people telling stories about, you know, the shooting and all of Tom Savini's great gags, et cetera, et cetera. But again, this 30 minute, little like mini doc spends more time on the actual restoration of the film than any extra I've ever seen on a disc like this. And I personally, as somebody who does not hoard but collects physical media, I really appreciated this, because it's a thing you don't actually get to see a lot of, the actual process of looking through the film, you know, the computer programs that are used to clean these up, not AI, but the color correction and all that stuff. Was there, when you were sitting down to make this feels like the sort of thing that you've wanted to show people for a long time. That's the sense I got watching this bonus feature, because spoiler, I have not watched all of them. There are a lot. It's the only one I think you appear on camera on.
It is my first time on camera, and there was a lot of debate about it.
Okay. Let me ask, were you pushed into this, or because this
self-debate?
Okay.
Because I was just like, this isn't about me. Like, I don't want to be involved, you know, on camera or anything like that. I was trying to figure out the best way to do it. And we were doing a Screen Factory anniversary screening at Vidiot's last year. And I was asked to do a speech. So I just brought my cameraman with me, which is kind of like, let's film this. Like, I kind of tell the story and there, I'm done. But then as we were doing the beginning of the extra, or I'm sorry, the beginning of the documentary, where the guy at the film vault, Jeff Flam, is talking about, you know, the search for it and everything, I realized I was just like, oh, maybe it'd be fun if I put like some inserts in here where I'm just kind of like MST3K-ing what he's saying. Yeah, that was the extra that I was the most nervous about. And it's been nice to see a couple of reviews that say that they actually like it, because it was the first time we've ever told a story like this. Because I knew that there was going to be questions. I knew there was going to be a ton of questions coming from the collectors community, from horror fans. So I was like, why don't we just nip this in the bud and just tell them exactly what we did? Because there's a lot of misinformation on, you know, forums like Blu-ray.com and everything, where people are talking about like the process of restoration, but it turns out like they don't know a heck of a lot about it. So I was like, well, why don't I also use this as sort of like a tutorial in a way?
As somebody who has written about this probably more frequently than my writers or than my readers want to hear about, but who I find this really interesting, and I think it's really important as archival, just as a matter of archiving, as a matter of keeping these things in the highest quality possible for the longest amount of time possible. I think it's really important. I think this is a real service. It's a real service to people to have this on a disc and show them how it gets done. So again, if you pick this setup, which you should, it's great. It's out. It's going to be out on 4K shortly after this goes live. So pre-order it now, and you'll get it. You'll get it in your sweaty little hands as soon as possible. But if you do, go to that last disc and watch the, I think it's called Monster Mania, is the title of it.
That was the code name for the film. I wanted to keep this very quiet because I knew that there were other companies that were searching for it.
Yeah.
Monster Mania. It'll drive you insania. It even had a tagline.
That's great. John, when you were sitting down for these, when you sit down for these interviews and you're talking about the making of the film, one thing that always jumps out, and you mentioned it here just now, is the Pittsburgh connection, this kind of close-knit filmmaking community that you guys had there, that George Romero had built. You know, Tom Savini is there again in Pittsburgh. You know, he's got a school there now, you know, a makeup school there now. He's got his company out there. That seems like a very important part of all of this. What was it about having that kind of more insular community that was separate from what was happening in, you know, New York or Los Angeles in particular, Hollywood, that really helped give these things a sense of specialness?
Well, I think that there was part of it. I think there was a little bit of us against the world kind of attitude. We were in Pittsburgh making these films completely independently. You got to remember, back then there was no Weinstein Company, no Focus Features, no Sony Classics. These things were done really independently, financed independently of the studio system, eventually with luck being distributed by the system. But that was George's whole intention for himself. He wanted to be free of the influences that would come down, that would just strictly commercial influences, which might dictate what he would do. So that was part of it. The other part of it was that because none of us really went to film schools, we didn't come out of that whole tradition, we had to all learn by doing. And it just so happens that Pittsburgh at the time, in the 70s, early 70s and then later into the 80s, was kind of a petri dish for people who wanted to learn how to make movies, because you had to learn by doing it. That was the only way you could learn. And fortunately, George had some success and gathered around him people who wanted to do it. If you wanted to do it, you know, that was an ultimate destination. And so it gave everybody, me, my partners, anybody that was in college. Also, we had places like Carnegie Mellon there with their fabulous drama school, so that costumers and set designers and scenics and carpenters and all kinds of people that were involved in that craft could all come together. And we actually moved from show to show. I had a small film production company with two partners of mine. We made a low budget feature called Effects that we made for like $55,000. Same crew, same guys. George was also with his partner, Richard Rubenstein. They had a really great run there for a while, where they had a deal with Salah Hassanin of UFD to do the Day of the Dead, Knight Riders, the Tales from the Dark Side television show emerged out of all of that. So it was kind of like a group effort. Everybody who wanted to be in the business was kind of there. And so once you started working together over time on film after film, you kind of developed a shorthand among each other, and it really and then of course we all hung out with each other all the time, so it just made it all the more enjoyable.
Yeah, you mentioned Carnegie Mellon. I believe that's where I think Lori Cardille, who is the plays the lead, she went there and was, I believe, acting off Broadway, on Broadway, up in New York at the time when she was hired for the film. I think I remember reading that in one of the, or seeing that in one of the the extras.
That's right.
And there are most of the people for this film, it seems, were pulled from the stage, which again makes sense. I assume it's easier to see. There's more acting opportunities on the stage in Pittsburgh and kind of New York up there than there is on film. But that does give the film a more heightened sensibility, maybe a more they were able to hit things that George Romero really wanted them to do in a way that does feel a little with, and this, maybe this is going to come out wrong, a little more stagey, a little more heightened, which is one of the things that still stands out about it, you know, now 40 years later, just how intense it feels.
Look at the movies that we were making. They were kind of hyperbolized, right? I mean, this wasn't naturalistic drama.
Yeah. No, that's for sure.
No, they were, listen, all of the, George, first of all, George, like me, like others, we all loved the theater. And we kind of came out of some of that background. George is originally from New York, and he spent a lot of time in New York, and we'd go to a lot of shows. And Laurie, as you pointed out, was from Pittsburgh, but she was in New York, and that's where he saw her. Terry Alexander, the same. And so it was a matter of just finding, as George would say, the best actors, the best people that would come and be willing to really put up with a lot of crap to get these low-budget independent movies made.
Yeah. Some of the stories, again, I don't want to spoil all the stories from the documentaries, but there is just you know, kind of one legendary one that has, you know, gone around a lot about the odorous day. Maybe we could
go ahead and talk about it. It's fine.
It's a heck of a story, John. Maybe you could just give folks the very short version of what folks had to put up with on that kind of climactic zombie feast day.
Well, the short version is when we were preparing for Rhodes's death, we had acquired quite a bit of offal, which is basically pig's guts and slime and flesh and all the good stuff. But we had to head down to Sanibel Island, to Fort Myers, to do the exterior shooting. And so my wife, who was actually a production coordinator, had everything stored in the refrigerators back in Tom and Greg's shop. But somebody forgot to plug in the refrigerators. So by the time we got back from being down in Florida, these things had a chance to percolate a little bit. And but we had to shoot. And so the idea was, well, okay, we're gonna do it. And I will leave it to those of you who are game enough to watch the extras to find out all the different versions of this story. But let's just say it was a very pungent a pungent day on the set. We were passing around Vaseline to wipe on our noses. We were wearing masks. The zombie extras had to sit there. And, of course, you know, as you're making movies, setups take a long time. So Joe was around in this platform where half his body was under the platform. The rest of it was trapped up here. Well, he couldn't go anywhere. And time came to shoot. All right, let's load him up. And we brought all the stuff out and loaded it up. And I'm amazed that he got through it because, man, he was gagging.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, watch the extras. You'll love it. It's a hell of a story. Jeff, you know, it's funny. The other day, just a couple days ago, somebody randomly asked me on Twitter, like, "Hey, why are there? Why do so many new releases have commentary tracks by historians or you know, critics for their discs?" And I have my own theories, but I figure since I have you on, this is a perfect chance to talk about this, because it's true. I've actually noticed the same thing. Lots of commentary tracks are, you know, folks who are fans, but also historians. This is not a new thing. I remember one of the first commentary tracks I ever listened to was Roger Ebert on Citizen Kane, right? Like, this is, you know, that's classic of the form. It's like film school in a box, that two hour set. But it is interesting to think about it when, and I'm, you know, and I listened to the Drew McQueenie Daniel Krauss track on this one. It's really interesting. It's like watching a movie with your friends, which is nice and like kind of a fun vibe. But they're also very smart and they have, you know, their own personal relationships with George Romero and the films, etc. But when you're sitting down to put these together, how are you thinking about the modern commentary track? Because it does feel like, again, it feels like there has been a slight evolution in how these things come together.
You nailed it. Absolutely nailed it for what exactly for what I'm looking for. Sitting down, listening to your friends talking about movies, but they're highly educated on the subject. I try to do that with every commentary. I loved listening to commentaries as like a teen, you know, going through film school and everything. I was, you know, just always listening to the film historians and all that. But as I got older, I was just kind of like, all right, they sound kind of stuffy, you know? So I decided I was going to try and put like an entertainment factor into it. And you nailed it. I try to make it sound like you're watching a movie with your friends.
Also on this disc, there is, I believe, an archival. Oh, it must be archival since George Romero's on it and he is no longer with us. But I assume it's an archival track from the 2013 release or maybe something else. But there is that kind of making of commentary track that's also on it, which is kind of interestingly complimentary. I guess one of my questions here is, do we just have so many of these archival making of commentary tracks that we almost don't need to make more of them? And that's why you can shift to the newer ones?
Just to add to what I was saying, I think in this day and age, we have IMDb. We have the IMDb trivia page. Anyone can go to that. Anyone can go and look up facts about the film. So I try to combine both, like some people that actually love it and are passionate about it, and but they aren't just throwing out, you know, IMDb facts.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually what I try to go for.
Yeah. No, it was an interesting evolution that has jumped out at me over the years. And look, you guys are making the work that you all are doing is, again, I think very important. For one kind of very specific reason that, so Drew McQueenie in this commentary track, he mentions that the curation being done by you and everybody else at Shout Factory is its own form of criticism. Like, this is kind of a modern leg of criticism, this ability to kind of point people in the direction of things they should be watching in our endless sea of, for lack of a better word, content. We got all this content. Hate that word. But we have all this content out there. And we got to figure out what to watch. And we need people who can point us to the things that are worth watching. When you're sitting down and you're putting together your list of, okay, here's what needs to be in our archive. Here's what needs to be in our archive. Like, what are you personally looking for? And like, what are you professionally looking for? Because it's not just, I would like to have Citizen Kane on Shout Factory. Let's have that. You can't just do it that way. There are limits on what you can acquire and what needs to be done. So when you're sitting down to do it, what are you thinking of when you're like, this is all right, this is what we're up to next?
Me personally, I just make a list of things that I love, things that I'm really passionate about, things where like I know I'm just gonna go nuts on with the extras and just make sure this thing is spick and span. But here's the thing, there are two other producers and we have, you know, different tastes in films. And so I think that's what really makes, you know, Shout and Scream and everything so vast in terms of the different genres that we do. Yeah, I mean, I still have a list of like things that I'm hoping to do in the next couple of years. But it's mostly stuff that I'm passionate about. But we also go into it with, we know that even though we might not be the biggest fans of a movie that we're working on, we do know that that is somebody's favorite movie out there. And so we make sure that we put 100% into it every single time.
Sure. Is there a... I mean, I assume there must be a commercial element that comes into play here at some point.
Oh, like, sure.
If we're gonna be spending the resources to get this made, you know, we have to make sure that it is something that enough people, a critical mass of people, will want to, you know, will want to pay money for. They're not cheap. They're, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna lie. The business element does come into it at times. There are a few films that I wanted to do that we just realized, like, it's probably not going to sell well. Which I, you know, understand.
Yeah,
it's business. But yeah, we try to get our passion projects and push for it, and hopefully they go through.
Jeff, you worked with Oliver Stone for a while. That's on your bio that I have here, and you worked with him on JFK, I believe, which is another great Shout Factory release, which I own and is great and is just immaculate.
Oh, thank you.
I'm a big fan of that movie. It is the best edited film I've ever seen. But when you're, I guess my question here is, when you're working on these things, are you bringing your own personal experiences to them? I don't know what that relationship is like. I don't want to, you know, make any assumptions here. But when you're putting like things like the JFK set together, which I believe you worked on, was that something that you're pulling from your personal life and experiences?
Well, I didn't work on the film at the time in 1991. Okay. I did not come on until Nixon. That was my first film with him. But for the JFK restoration, it was sort of getting the band back together. We hadn't seen each other in a long time and everything. And, you know, I was just kind of like, I'm the captain now, you know, as we're working JFK. Oliver is great. Super easy to work with. Most of the stories that you have heard are not true. I can tell you that.
Okay.
But it's been such a pleasure to get to work with him again, like, after all these years. Like, I started working with him when I was 20, and here I am at an age, and we're working together again. It's been fantastic.
You guys also put out Alexander, right? Not too long ago.
Yes.
That was a.
That one I worked on.
That one, that's an interesting one, because it feels like we're now in another sword and sandal cycle here. We've got the Odyssey coming out. You know, people are excited for that. I don't know. Do you have any fun stories of working with Oliver Stone? I'll just put it that way. It's people love stories. People love to hear stories about the making of things. Do you have any good Oliver Stone stories? The horror stories are false. Let's hear some of the good ones.
Oh, God. I have a million. I have a million stories. I can go into two books, but none I can really say out loud. I'll tell you this. One of the highlights from working with him in that original block was, a lot of people don't know that, like, some of his favorite movies are comedies. Mm-hmm. Like Caddyshack and all that. And one day we were just sitting around the house, and I don't even remember how it came up. We just started talking about Mars Attacks, and we were talking about how much we loved it. And there was me and Oliver Stone sitting in his house going to each other. So, you know, yeah, that's a part of him that I think a lot of people don't know. He's a big fan of comedies.
That's interesting. Mars Attacks is great. I've always had a soft spot for that. That's when I did see it in theaters. That's when I was like the perfect age to see it. I think it was 14 or something. John, one of the things that comes up a lot in the documentaries about Day of the Dead is working underground for so long, which does feel like, you know, it just a real nightmare on the circadian rhythms and the lungs and everything else. What was it like to not see the sun for 8 weeks? How did that feel?
Well, it was actually longer than that. It was almost an experience of being in a movie. because you would wake up in the morning, it would be dark outside, you would drive to the set, you would go down into the mine, you'd be there all day. The temperature was a constant 53 degrees, never changed, kind of damp. And you'd come out and it would be dark because we shot it in the winter. So it was, the days were shorter. And you had to live down there. You ate down there. You basically the whole thing. And of course, once you were in the mine, which were limestone caverns, the air was, you didn't see it a lot, but the air was full of dust. And so you would blow your nose and there would be all this black stuff. And there was a fun thing going through the crew. We'd all come down one after another with what we used to call minitis, which was kind of like a cold. I don't really know what it was. We had a physician on call who would come around and give B12 shots. So you were always kind of a bit uncomfortable, and maybe in some odd way that helped with the creativity, because you were never able to kind of sort of lie around, you were always moving. In those kinds of films, you know, you don't really have a lot of downtime. You try to move as fast as you can to get it done within the budget and the schedule that you have. And then, of course, when we got to the one period of time where we knew we were going to Florida, it was kind of like everybody was just, the first day we landed, we got to the hotel. We didn't have to be shooting, I think, for another day. And so it was like spring break. I mean, the clothes came off. Everybody was in the pool. Everybody was completely tore up. It was just like we've been released. We've been liberated.
Oh, I bet. The kind of claustrophobia and of that whole underground section really contributes to the kind of I say oppressive vibe here, but that, you know, I
absolutely know it does. You're right.
Like it's got that real the walls are closing in vibe. The world is coming to an end. The walls are closing in.
Yep.
Which I, you know, look, I could only imagine if I had discovered this film during COVID, for instance, you know, that would have been, you know, but it does feel eternally relevant. You mentioned that George Romero always was putting these kind of ideas into his movies. When you sit down and rewatch it now, what about what was portrayed in, you know, this film that came out 42, 43 years ago, still jumps out at you as like, okay, this is definitely still relevant today?
Well, I think it's just the way society has fragmented under that kind of stress. You have people who want to maintain a certain kind of order, which is natural. The human being needs order in order to survive. There's another group that just wants to figure out how to cure it, how to fix it. There's a madness to that, which is represented by Logan, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got these two competing forces trying to, and of course, realizing that you're really kind of, in a way, the last people on Earth. So it's a competition of how this is going to happen. What about the humanity, which is basically represented by Sarah and Laurie's character? How do we balance the need for a working order where we can all work together to survive, but we also need to try experiments, and we don't really, she doesn't know, of course, how mad Logan is and what he's been doing to the other soldiers and trying to teach Bub how to behave like a human being, which is kind of a ridiculous enterprise. So I think that, and then of course you've got the environment itself, which is we are trapped in this environment that really gives us no relief. And this is our world. These were all themes that I think George was playing with. And, It basically is, well, this could be society. This is a microcosm of how society might break down.
One thing the film really, again, just rewatching it several times this week in various iterations, one thing that does jump out, and I've always liked about it, it's one of the reasons it's always been one of my favorites here, is that there are protagonists or antagonists, but the antagonists in the military, the kind of crazy, leader who just wants to be in charge of everything, is not entirely wrong. The soldiers are not entirely wrong to be horrified by what they see the scientists doing at the end of the day, because it is actually insane. It is completely nuts. And that kind of multivariate insanity is really there. You always have the temptation to go too hard one way or the other with these things, and I think Romero kind of perfectly split the middle here.
Yeah, I mean, if you listen to Rhodes without seeing him, if you could just read his speeches, you sort of think, well, actually, the guy has a point. He just happens to be so over the top and so insane himself that it's kind of like, well, I sure don't want to follow this guy. On the other side, though, you've got Logan, who is willing to do the most horrible, horrible things in the effort to find a cure in the process of science, right? So Sarah is really kind of caught in the middle, and John is basically the one who has the 30,000 foot view of all of this, the helicopter pilot, Terry Alexander's character. And he gives that really beautiful speech when they're out at the at their trailer in the middle of the mine, and Sarah visits him, and that's George talking, and it really is his view of and you could say that it's a little bit pessimistic, fatalistic. On the other hand, you could also say it's very realistic, and when he says, well, I'm just going to go to an island and enjoy what time I got left, given the world as it is and the competing forces that are trying to take command or take control or even just survive, what choice do you have? I mean, I certainly don't want to be in Logan's camp, and I certainly don't want to be in Rhodes's camp. Well, maybe the island is a sane choice.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was pretty much everything I wanted to ask. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if there's anything you think folks should know either about the making of the film itself or the set that y'all have put together. John, let's start with you. Is there anything folks should know about what did we not discuss that we should have?
Oh, no, I think we covered it pretty well. I mean, I'm glad that people want to talk about sort of the, not just the shocks and the scares of what George was trying to do in these movies, the storytelling that he was, because he was at heart a great storyteller. He was a great horror movie maker, but he really, and it's a shame it's a shame in one way and not a shame in another way that somebody has that kind of success is really pigeonholed into a kind of channel for the kinds of movies that he could make. But having spent so much time with him and having been one of his close friends, I could really see the breadth of his artistic vision and appetite. And in a way, it's kind of a shame that he never got to do some of the things that he wanted to do. On the other hand, he would say, listen, zombies have been very good to me, so I'm happily ensconced in the horror genre.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. Jeff, what should we have talked about?
Well, people love the Day of the Dead score. John, do you want to talk a little bit about the process and
I can tell you, and I referred to this earlier. I had a really unique relationship with George because I was his assistant director. Also, we were good friends. So we spent a lot of time together. We'd always be out drinking with each other. The wives and all of us would all be getting together and having parties and stuff like that. So there was a great opportunity for me to kind of know aesthetically what he was trying to do. It didn't start as formalized as John Harrison's going to write the score. It was kind of like I was the guy with the piano. And everybody did everything, and that started with Creepshow. But the great thing about it was, as his assistant director, I was on the set every day, and so I could see each scene coming together, how it was composed, what George was trying to do. We could talk about it. And I basically went back in the early days of post, and I temped the entire movie. I came up to Pittsburgh. I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and I brought my gear back and moved into the basement of 247, which was George's offices. And while he and Pat Buba were upstairs cutting the movie, they would come downstairs and drop videotapes through the mail slot of my door, and I would put them up. And it was all analog back then. I don't have some of the gear here, but my Prophet 5 synthesizer and piano and other gear that I had a 4-track tape recorder and a 2-track tape recorder, and I just bounced stuff back and forth and basically created the score that you've heard. I was able to take it upstairs, lay it up, see what worked, what didn't, revise it. So by the time I went into the studio to record the score for real with my producer, John Sutton, I had basically written the whole thing and done it all. Now, that's kind of unusual. Composers usually don't have that kind of relationship. I mean, there are a few that have really tight relationships, John Williams and Steven Spielberg, Bernard Herrmann, Hitchcock, that kind of stuff. But to be able to actually write the music while the movie's in post-production, there's a lot of reasons why, time, budget, so forth and so on. But I had that opportunity. It was kind of unique. And so I really felt that I was able to tailor make the music to the movie.
Yeah. It is great. I've always loved it. And I was kind of surprised to hear that people did not originally love it. You know, it's always funny coming to these things slightly after the fact, and seeing some of the original receptions of them and just being like, how did everybody get it so wrong? It's
I think, you know, it just takes time. Like I said, the movie was not popular when it first came out. It took a while for it to, and then of course, stuff like what Jeff is doing has really helped people see it in all the different aspects of how it was made, why it was made, what it means. And of course, timing is also great. I mean, we look at the world around us, and there's a lot of Day of the Dead that is kind of referenced there.
Yeah. That is for sure. Jeff, anything else?
Actually, you know what? You have the director of Tales from the Dark Side, the movie here, also available from Scream Factory.
Oh, that's true. That is, okay. Well, we're going to have to do another.
Whole other show.
Yeah, that is another episode right there. Now that I've got your guys' contact.
Sell those discs.
Now that I got your guys' contact info, don't worry. I'm going to be bugging you.
Let me do a little shout out here, because the Shout Factory version of Tales from the Dark Side is, everybody should buy it.
Yeah, I say that about all their releases, but this is true.
Absolutely. They're the best.
It's great. We do live in a weird golden age of physical media, particularly for these really nice sets. You know, there's a strange thing that has happened that, like, as the normie viewer has kind of gravitated towards streaming and whatever. There are these just wonderful collections out there that for the real fans are unbeatable. Like, just nothing like it in history. So it's a fun time to be a movie fan, which is,
and they're good historical documents too. I mean, we were talking earlier about the kinds of extras and stuff that go. I mean, they are wonderful historical documents about this medium that we all love.
I remember when I was in college and was like kind of going through the university library system. They had the 3-disc DVD of Brazil that Criterion put out, I don't know, back in the late 90s. And that was a revelation. It was just like, oh, here's all the different cuts of these movies. Oh, here's all the documentaries of people talking about them. And like that sort of thing is just, invaluable. Like you cannot learn more about the making of movies than with that sort of thing. It's just,
oh,
great.
Yeah. In film school, or when I was in film school, it was like laser discs were starting to become popular.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And you know, none of us had any money to buy a Laserdisc player. So what we would do is we would go down to a Laserdisc shop in Boston, grab two VCRs from everybody's, you know, everyone had a VCR in their room. So we'd borrow two VCRs, go over to the college library, which had a Laserdisc player, and then put that Laserdisc on VHS. But we'd have to sit there all day because we would first get the movie, but then we'd have to do it again in order to get the commentary. And so all of us would then sit in a room and watch, you know, some of our favorite films with commentaries. And that was a film education in and of itself.
Wouldn't it have been great that things like Shout Factory and Scream had been available in the 40s and the 50s, and so that some of these wonderful movies that we all grew up on that have influenced all the filmmakers we're talking about, to be able to have that kind of documentation for the movies. I mean, thank God for TCM. At least there's that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also wish, you know, the foresight was there to really take care of some of these old.
Well, digital changed it all, right, Jeff? I mean, the recording and the availability of being able to do the kinds of things that you guys do, that's really made it happen.
Yeah.
The extras and the re-releases and the collectibles.
Thank you. Thank you so much for saying that. I mean, we really don't hear a lot of that. A majority of what we hear is negative, where it's like, oh, why didn't you get this person? Why didn't you get this person to a commentary?
In the years to come, the kinds of things that you guys are doing will be the versions that everybody has.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
No,
yeah.
There are
too many. Because it'll have all this stuff with it.
Yeah.
And people will want that.
Oh, well, thank
you.
And
it is invaluable. And the naysayer, like, again, I hear the naysayers out there too. And I'm just like, what do you people want? Like,
it's a question I ask myself every day.
What do you people want? Like, it's like this is a, anyway. That's a podcast for another day too. The haters, the complainers. All right. John and Jeff, thank you for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
If I could just say this at the end, you know, the old saying is never meet your heroes. And I can tell you that John and the entire cast and crew of Day of the Dead are the counterpoint to that. Some of the nicest people I have ever met in this business. So thank you, John.
Well, thank you. It was great to be part of it.
And again, thank you guys for being on the show. This has been a real treat for me personally. I hope everybody else enjoys it who is out there listening too, and make sure you go pick up the movie. Again, it's I keep saying this, it is my favorite of these early Romero films, and it's it really does hold up today. Like, in a world of digital CGI AI shenanigans, it's nice to see like actual real physical filmmaking, and see some of the ways that it got made in these special features. So
I can tell you a lot of love was put into this, not just from Shout, but from Duplitech as well, the restoration company.
Yeah, you can tell it does look great. Okay, my name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and we'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.